You're listening to WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan, and we are raising funds today for the WMNF 2-day mini fund drive. It'll end today, 813-238-8001. Right now, we're in the middle of the Counterspin show, and I want to thank LaLena Hopper from Newport Richey, who has contributed $88.50 to support community radio. LaLena says, I love Tuesdays with Marcy, and we listen every day, love all the talk and music. So thank you so much for that donation of $88.50, LaLena from Newport Richey, and she is getting the WMNF t-shirt. As I've mentioned, this is a great new t-shirt, a blue-gray kind of color, really unique and interesting and visually pleasing color. And the design is super bold and super simple at the same time. And it says WMNF 88.5. You will love this t-shirt. I can't wait to get it myself. 813-238-8001. The design is by Todd Bates, a local graphic artist in St. Petersburg. $88.50 contribution to community radio. You can call 813-238-8001 or pledge online at WMNF.org. Well, we do need to hear your support. We do need you to call and go to the website to donate. But right now, let's hear the rest of Counterspin, and we'll be back in just a few minutes to thank everyone who has contributed support. We'd like to thank you either anonymously or by thanking you by name. If you call 813-238-8001 and make a $50 or $100 contribution to community radio, WMNF.org. Here's Counterspin in progress.
You know, so it's new when it's not new, and there ought to be a way for news media to convey that.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, you know, what we've seen is an unwillingness to really show the perspective inside of the Palestinian people. And sometimes when it does make it to a major media outlet or market, it's really watered down. And we've all, as Palestinian advocates, been through that process. You know, we'll pitch an op-ed and, you know, we'll get so many revisions, or, you know, we just won't hear back and the op-ed would not have the opportunity to be placed. And so we have something to say. We've been saying it, but unfortunately, major media outlets have been unwilling to take the leap and actually hear the Palestinian people and hear our story and share our stories.
Well, I saw a great conversation that you were part of, hosted by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee with Noor Eric Khat and Ajamu Dillahunt about Palestinian solidarity with Black communities and just kind of putting things in an international context, connecting us, you know. And you were, I didn't mention earlier, you're a co-founder of Dream Defenders, which I know informs your work. These aren't connections that news media make, you know, between Palestinians and African Americans. They obscure them, actually. But people see those connections, right? That international connection, that across-border connection, that people see that even if media hide it.
That's right. And I think we're seeing new opportunities for that through social media. In fact, in the summer uprisings in Ferguson, social media played a huge role in connecting Palestinian activists and Black activists over the shared experience of being tear gassed. It was literally in the moment live tweeting support from Palestinians on the ground saying to their counterparts in Ferguson, this is how you resist, this is the direction you should run in, this is what you should wash your eyes out with. And really, that was born out of a genuine sentiment of solidarity. And what's most beautiful and what we like to highlight at Dream Defenders is that the work that we were doing, and again, the work that so many others have been doing, is a part of a historic connection between the Black Freedom Movement, the Black Power Movement, and the Palestinian Liberation Movement. This relationship has existed for decades, and folks like Alice Walker and Angela Davis have been mentioning that to us. But also, you can look at the record of the Black Panther Party, who were unapologetic about their stance on Palestine, and similarly, organizations like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which certainly was a part of a lot of controversy when they made their statement on Palestine. So we know this is a part of a legacy, a rich tradition in fighting for all peoples across the world, all colonized peoples, all peoples who have been victims of imperialism, to be able to join together and envision a better future for us all.
Well, I just wanted finally to give you an opportunity, in terms of talking about positive interventions, to talk about decolonize Palestine, to talk about that resource collection, that project. What is that about, and how do you hope that folks will use that? What kind of intervention do you see that serving?
Even, I believe, AOC was tweeting just the other day about Puerto Rico, and people are talking a lot about statehood as one of the solutions, but she mentioned decolonization as a necessary part of the conversation as it relates to Puerto Rico. And similarly, when we think about Israel and Palestine, we can't simply suggest that Palestinian people should just be taken within into the system of Zionism and incorporated into that system, because until we decolonize the root cause of the oppression, the root cause of the inequity, the root cause of the injustice, then we're really just going to be bringing more people into an oppressive state. And an analogy that comes to mind is when Dr. King suggested in his later years that he feared that he had actually marshaled his people into a burning house.
Right.
And so when that applies to Israel and Palestine, we have to think about decolonizing the very structures that privilege Jews over non-Jews, the very structures that allow for settlers to walk into homes right now in East Jerusalem and take those homes, the very structures that allow for the West Bank settlements to have access to as much water as they need. Meanwhile, the nearby Palestinian communities have a rationing of the water. And so these are all structures that need to be abolished if we're to truly see a reality on the ground that fosters an environment where, again, Jews and non-Jews can live happily side by side, equally enjoying the Holy Land that we all cherish so much. But Zionism is what is in the way of that possibility, and so we must decolonize and envision a future where we can actually be free and just and human.
We've been speaking with Ahmed Abujaneh. He's executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. You can find their work online at uscpr.org. Ahmed Abujaneh, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
A recent New York Times story, pressure mounts to lift patent protections on coronavirus vaccines, reported that President Biden and drug makers face demands from, quote, liberal activists and global leaders, close quote, to suspend intellectual property rights on vaccines as people continue to die and suffer myriad long-term harms from a virus for which vaccines exist. It's possible to overwork Plato's metaphor of shadows on the cave wall, where you get caught up in the image of the thing and lose track of the real. But when you read, quote, the debate on waiving an international intellectual property agreement that protects pharmaceutical trade secrets is both a political and a practical problem for President Biden, who has vowed to restore the U.S. as a leader in global health, close quote. You might wonder where the people are. The dead and the sick and the ones who don't even know they're sick and their families and loved ones. There is assuredly a human interest story to be found elsewhere, maybe with big, poignant photographs. But what's lost by not bringing those voices into this straight news story, where an investment banker is cited on the terrible, terrible precedent opening access to vaccine production would set? Quote, what it would say to the industry is, don't work on anything that we really care about, because if you do, we're just going to take it away from you, close quote. And then finally, what's this all to do with Bill Gates? Joining us now to put it together is James Love, director of Knowledge Ecology International. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jamie Love.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Well, we're recording on May 6th, and things are shifting as we speak. There has been, I understand, a waiver on those intellectual property rights. But I'll ask you then just to kind of drop us in where we're at. You know, that same New York Times story, which I'm just using to stand in for a lot of coverage, talked about debate inside the White House, you know, that some advisors to President Biden say there's a moral imperative to act, you know, to get more vaccines out to more people. But, quote, others say spilling closely guarded but highly complex trade secrets into the open would do nothing to expand the global supply of vaccines, close quote. So that seems to be the gist of the argument. I wonder, before you even talk about Bill Gates, can you talk about this idea that, oh, everybody wants everyone to get vaccines, but somehow loosening patent protections or IP rights isn't the way to get there?
The time story you talked about, there's two different things that we're talking about. One are the issue of the patents themselves, which are not secret. Patents are granted, they're published, and anyone can read them. That's one of the important things about a patent. Trade secrets are things where those have to do with the know-how, how to manufacture a vaccine. And those things are often kept secret by a company. So in the current environment where you're trying to increase the manufacturing and the supply of vaccines so you can vaccinate more people around the world and do it faster, both of these things are important. The patent is an exclusive right. It allows somebody that has ownership of an invention to prevent anyone but themselves from practicing that invention. So that can make it illegal to manufacture a vaccine, for example. If you acquire somehow, either by paying for the patent or having the government override the patent right through a compulsory license to that patent, where the government forces the owner of the patent to give a license to someone to manufacture, then you still are faced with this problem of, do you know how to manufacture it? Where's the know-how? And that will often involve a lot of things that you could describe in some cases as trade secrets. So both of these things are important for scaling the vaccine response.
Well, so then what about the idea that allowing access to them actually wouldn't change the global supply of vaccines, which is an argument that's been put forward by, among other people, Bill Gates, who, as you've written and talked about recently, is a real powerful force in this sphere?
I think most people would agree that if you somehow got rid of the barriers that patents present by forcing people that own the patented inventions to allow third-party generic manufacturers to use those inventions to make a generic vaccine, and also shared the know-how, that would, in fact, definitely expand the production and supply of vaccines. I think that what Bill Gates' opinion is that that's a bad idea. He would argue that breaking down the strong protection of patent rights and know-how would be bad in some ways, because he thinks the private ownership of both the know-how and the inventions is a positive. He thinks that what makes the world go around. He's a strong advocate of strong monopolies on both inventions and know-how. He thinks that's necessary in order to get private investment. But it's a pretty weak argument in the particular case, because every single vaccine that's on the market today has had the backing of governments in the development. Even the Pfizer vaccine, which the Pfizer CEO likes to claim didn't get any research contracts in the U.S., they started out with 400 million euros from Germany and another 100 million in support from the European Commission and a $1.95 billion advance purchase contract for the United States. And that's not really completely a story of free enterprise. That's a story of governments really putting money into developing the vaccine. For Moderna's vaccine, for the Novavax vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and for the AstraZeneca vaccine, all of those other vaccines had even more support from governments. And you can say the same thing about some of the vaccines in development or from other countries like Russia or Cuba. What you have right now is a lot of government money that's gone into vaccine development being privatized by a handful of companies. And those companies say, you know, we're going to decide who's allowed to manufacture and who's not allowed to manufacture and how fast things go and what prices we want to charge. But there's massive economic dislocation worldwide. You have kids out of school. You have people losing businesses. You have people getting evicted, defaulting on loans, mental health problems, and everything else. And the companies, it's not like they're not making any money. Pfizer this year says they're going to make $26 billion in selling their vaccine. Moderna claims they're going to make about $20 billion selling a vaccine that the U.S. government paid for. And the CEO of Moderna said now to be worth over $5 billion. So I don't think we have to really worry too much about these companies not making any money.
And not being inspired to do more or to innovate or whatever supposedly the inhibition is going to be.
At the beginning of the pandemic, most of the companies, with the notable exception of Pfizer, but a number of the companies claimed that they were going to operate in a nonprofit basis. As we go deeper and deeper in the pandemic, and now Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson, even AstraZeneca, are all talking about raising prices. In some cases, they're throwing on numbers like a tenfold increase in the price of the products. As we move down the road, Pfizer suggests you might need to be vaccinated every single year. When you're talking about vaccinating the entire planet, it becomes pretty expensive.
Well, let me ask you, there's plenty to be said about how being wealthy, however you get there, evidently conveys expertise, at least according to U.S. news media and to many other actors in society. Part of the reason that people have a kind of distorted or misleading understanding of the balance of arguments in terms of vaccinating people has to do with media coverage and the outsized voices of people like Bill Gates. I wanted to ask you just finally about media coverage. You know, I mean, if we're talking about Gates, he's an expert on malaria, he's an expert on public education, now he's an expert on vaccines, and we definitely, if you just look at sources, you know, I'm not sure the voices we're hearing are the voices that we actually necessarily need to hear. What's your thinking on that?
Well, there's the song, If I Was a Rich Man, which is the notion that people think just because you're rich, you must know. And that's one issue that you have. But it's more than that. Gates personally and his foundation, which has some of his money, spends a huge amount of money on public relations. They fund a lot of media organizations. They give money to BBC, they give money to lots of organizations that cover public health, and so they've tended to give very favorable coverage to the projects that Gates is involved in. They offer money to all rich organizations, whether or not they take it or not, so it's out there. We were once approached one publication, the Washington Monthly, about doing a story that involved Gates' support of media organizations, and the reporter came back, he said he talked to his editors, and this was really a small niche publication in Washington, D.C., one that we liked, but it wasn't really a major one. And the editor said, that's a great story, but we also have a grant application out to the Gates Foundation, so we're just not going to write it. Yeah. And there's that kind of problem. And then there's the fact that not just Gates personally, his expertise, but his organization. They have consultants. They have organizations they fund that work on vaccines. He plays an important role in CEPI and in COVAX, two of the organizations who play a role in development of, and in distribution of vaccines for infectious diseases. He has consulting firms like McKinsey or Boston Consulting Group that work with him. And he knows the CEOs of companies. He has a lot of contacts and things like that. So when the pandemic hit, very few people in government knew anything about vaccines or anything about infectious diseases. And so Gates is a famous guy. He has some expertise. So people would like, you know, what does he have to say? And because he was giving away a fair amount of money or managing money, people like Warren Buffett were donating money. He seemed like he must be a pretty honest broker because he's pretty free of any kind of conflict, mm-hmm. unlike a company. But Gates himself has an ideological connection to strong intellectual property rights ever since he was in college. He's always thought that strong intellectual property rights and strong privatization of government-funded research were good things, not bad things. He's been focused on that his entire life, and I don't think people realize how radical he is on those views. Even during the height of the AIDS pandemic, when there was very few people getting access to treatment, he was trying to block every effort to expand access to generic HIV drugs, despite the fact that there was probably 9,000 people a day dying from the disease at the time. So here we are, fast forward, it's a pandemic, it's COVID, and he's telling people, no, don't worry about things. We've got the manufacturing all ready to go. We've working with all the best people, all the best companies. We know more about this. The people that want more open sourcing of the vaccine are anti-capitalist, nothing activists. You know, listen to me, I give you better advice. So that was sort of the early role he was doing. And then he started to use his surrogates, like the Center for Global Development and other groups, to lobby against the TRIPS waiver. He personally started lobbying against it. And when he was interviewed on Sky News about a different issue than the patent issue, he was asked about the know-how issue. He said he was opposed to sharing the recipe or the know-how, how to make a vaccine with developing countries, and more broadly, making it more public. And I think that's a ridiculously dangerous position to take, because the companies that they're manufacturing vaccines right now are not remotely close to meeting demand. And if you go at the pace that they prefer, which is to keep the technology closer and control the pricing mechanisms, you'll have a slower rollout. That exposes us to risks of new variants. And it means people that have less power and less money around the world are the people, you know, last in line. And that line's going to be pretty long if you don't speed up the production. So it's been difficult because he's an outsized voice. And I think Gates is a smart guy. He's not the only smart guy around or smart woman around. I think people need to listen to other views. And actually, Gates has had a mental block about these issues. And so some of his arguments just don't add up.
All right, then we'll end there for now with an eye towards tracking it as we go forward. We've been speaking with James Love. He's director of Knowledge Ecology International. They're online at keionline.org. Thank you so much, Jamie Love, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Counterspin on WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan, and joining me in the studios is Sam Vall, our program director. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Yes.
Now, we want to thank some people who have called in their donations during the last few minutes of Counterspin. Just remember that we're going to be playing Counterspin, at least for the time being, at 10:30 every Tuesday morning, and that's going to follow Economic Update by Richard Wolf, which will be coming to you every week at 10. And I want to thank some people who have donated in the meantime. We have a generous donation from Lakeland, a $20 contribution. And this person says that it's in memory of four people who were killed while they were worshiping. He likes Third Opinion. Thank you for that donation. And Sam got some people who also are thanking them right now during this hour of fundraising.
Yes, yes. We actually have two donations, both the same amount, both for $88.50, 88.5. I see what you did there. One from Anonymous and another one from Ted Morris in Newport Richey. Ted, he used his donation to get the WMNF t-shirt that we have, the new design from Ted Bates, Ted Bates Creative, which is that super cool circular logo right in the middle with our call letters in it. But then the call letters, I think that they are holding lightning bolts. That's what I interpret the design to be. But yeah, go on our website, WMNF.org, see if you interpret it that way. But it's cool that we have local artists designing a t-shirt for us, just another way that we want to give back to the local community. And if you want a t-shirt like that as well, if you want this t-shirt designed by Todd Bates, just go to our site, WMNF.org. There's a tip jar at the very top of the page. You can donate there. Or all of our phone lines, actually three out of the four of our phone lines are open. We have one call right now. If you want to call, just go to 813-238-8001.
We do need to hear from you. We need your support to keep the community radio station going. And as Sam was saying, the number to call in is 813-238-8001. You can go to our secure website at WMNF.org to donate as well. Any of the great programs that we're bringing you this morning, they need your support. We had Democracy Now! Earlier. We are listening to Counterspin and Economic Update. Alternative radio, we're not going to play today, but it's going to find its place in the schedule, at least temporarily, every single week, alternative radio. So if you like any of these shows, please call in and support it, 813-238-8001. In a few minutes, we're going to listen to the very last 8 minutes of Democracy Now! That we didn't get to this morning. They were about to present a very important story about the MOVE bombing and the victims of the MOVE bombing in Philadelphia from the 1980s. And how the remains of the children are being used in academia. That's a story that we had to pause at the beginning of the morning. And I wanted to bring it back to you to hear the last 8 minutes of that show in just a few minutes. But right now we are asking for your donations. 813-238-8001. And later on, I just want to give you a preview of what we're going to bring you today is after Democracy Now!, we're going to feature a few of Daniel's stories from the last few months. He's been doing some hard-hitting news reporting, and some of the stories are too long for our afternoon headlines, and they're 4 or 5 minutes long, and so we wanted to bring them to you right now during the midpoint block, which is next hour, and you'll be able to hear some of Daniel talk about some of his stories that he's done, and you'll be able to hear them. So if that's something that you support as well, give us a call, 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org. We really think that this community radio station, 88.5, is worth supporting. We think that it's something that you and your community, your family, your neighbors, it brings a value to all of you to have it on the airwaves, and we can only keep it on the airwaves with your help.
Mm-hmm.
813-238-8001 or WMNF.org.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty amazing that there is a local community station right here in Tampa Bay that has that local hard-hitting news. It has the locally programmed music. It is so unique. I was even just talking to Rick, our general manager, about this, saying how even compared to other non-commercial radio stations throughout the country, WMNF is pretty unique, even in the sense that we let our DJs and we let our programmers pick out their own music. We have a local team of news reporters here going out into the community, getting these stories and bringing them to light where they may not be able to get to light or be talked about on any other radio station. It's pretty unique what we have going on here, and we definitely want to keep it going. But the only way that we can keep it going is by donations from you, listeners like you. If you listen all the time and you've yet to donate and to help, please, please do. Now is the time. 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org.
And one of the best ways that you can donate is by becoming a sustaining member to WMNF. If you can join our circle of friends, if you call our phone answerers, the volunteers that are here to answer your phones, You can ask them about Circle of Friends, and they'll tell you. It's a sustaining membership. It happens every month. You do the initial paperwork. It'll take about a minute or two for you to get your bank account information or your credit card information, whichever you prefer. You get it to the station, and then it goes into effect, and you just tell us how much every month you would like to donate to the radio station, and then it happens automatically. It's really the best way to become a sustaining member of WMNF is to join our Circle of Friends, and you can do that as low as little as $5 a month. Some people do $10 a month or $20. And earlier, we heard someone who is already donating $25 a month has upped her contribution, her monthly contribution, to $50 a month.
Amazing.
To contribute to WMNF. So let that be an inspiration to you. Maybe you can afford $5 or $10 a month to join our circle of friends. 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org.
And Sean, that's an amazing point, because this pandemic has been hitting everybody hard. It's been a really rough time, to say the least. But however, it's hit some people more than others. So we completely understand if you can only donate, right, $5 a month, or just a one-time donation of $10, $20, $30 a month, we totally understand and we completely appreciate it. However, if you are also a listener who is maybe it's a little more fortunate throughout this pandemic, has a little bit more money, and you would be able to donate even more than, say, your neighbor, then that's fantastic. And we please implore you to donate, to use that generosity towards your local community radio station, your listener-supported radio station. You can do that by going to WMNF.org, hit up that tip jar, or calling 813-238-8001. All of our phone lines are open. We have four volunteers in our conference room right now that just are just waiting for your phone call. I mean, the phone lines are open. So please, 813-238-8001.
And we're going to go back now to listen to the very end of today's Democracy Now! We heard the whole show earlier, except the last 8 minutes or so. Amy and Juan were about to introduce their guests are going to talk about the MOVE bombing in the 1980s. So here is the last 8 minutes of Democracy Now! From today. Please, while you're listening, give us a call, 813-238-8001, or pledge on the web at WMNF.org to make great programs like Democracy Now!, keep them on the air in the Tampa Bay area, keep WMNF 88.5 FM going strong. Here's the end of today's Democracy Now!
Science was based on this notion that humans had different ancestors, right? That different races had different ancestors. And he tried to posit the idea that you could tell the intellectual capacity of a race by measuring skulls. And so to do his scientific work, he would purchase skulls from plantations. There's skulls that were grave robbed from a local potter's field in Philadelphia of 14 Black Philadelphians. Their remains were stolen. And this collection, like you said, has indigenous folks, has poor white people. And his science was basically trying to legitimize the institution of slavery by stating that, you know, Black folks and other people, like indigenous people, had less capacity for intellectual, thought than white people. And so about 2 years ago, I started calling for the repatriation of the remains housed in the Morton Collection. And that escalated. And then around the uprising, Police Free Penn formed, calling again for repatriation for the abolition of policing on campus. And in that context, they restated my demand for repatriation. Penn then creates a committee to consider the question of repatriation and reburial. And there was more momentum around this conversation. Then almost a year later, Paul Wolf Mitchell, a PhD student, then identifies, oh, they don't just have the 53 crania that we originally thought they had, right? 51 crania from a plantation in Cuba, in Vedado, and then two from black folks in the U.S. They additionally have 14 crania of black Philadelphians grave robbed from Franklin Field, which is a part of Penn's campus. It's an athletic field that used to be a burial site. And so when that happened, it reignited the call for a repatriation. There was a protest, and there were, demands stated at that protest to repatriate the remains, or if they can be repatriated, to give them to descendant communities to bury them. And after that happened, that's when the story came to me about Penn Museum's possession of Tree and Delicia's remains.
I'd like to bring in Mike Africa Jr. to the conversation. Mike, how are the families and the MOVE community processing and responding to these latest developments on what happened with the remains of two of the children in the bombing?
First of all, thank you for having me on the show to put out this information. The people in our family, as you can imagine, are still very shaken up and disturbed and traumatized, re-traumatized. You know, we were supposed to do this thing this year because the city council, City Councilwoman Jamie Gaultier pushed for an apology from the city council and the city of Philadelphia for dropping the bomb. And there was this like possible opportunity to like really start talking about how we can reconnect and recommit and reobserve and all of these things for what happened on May 13th, 1985. And although we never forget about what happened, you know, just going back to that day to try to learn from it so that it never happens again. You know, it's like one of these things where you can't even begin to heal because the harm is still being done. And so, like, everybody is just re-traumatized and have to relive May 13th all over again. And to find out that this happened to two of the children, you know, it's devastating. You know, it gives me the creeps just listening to the reports about what happened to our sisters. Everybody in the family are just stuck right now.
In fact, Mike, you knew Tree, you knew Delicia, you lived and played with them on a farm in Virginia.
Yeah, I did. We lived for years. For years together. See, the thing is, we were all like unconventional orphans, right? All of our parents were in prison. And so we were always together because the other people, the caretakers of the organization, they took us in because like my parents were in prison, just like Tree's mother was, and just like Delicia's parents were, you know? So yeah, we were always together. We were always doing everything together, eating together. We played together. We cried together. We were in fear together, you know? To hear about this, it's devastating.
Mike, in your book that you've written 50 Years on a Move, you talk about the history of the relations between MOVE and the political establishment and the police department in Philadelphia. And as you know, I was a young reporter back then in Philadelphia at the time. I lived through the 78 confrontation and the killing of Officer Ramp, which obviously was from police fire, not from the MOVE compound then. And then, of course, the 1985 bombing as well. Could you talk about the situation back then, especially under Mayor Rizzo, Frank Rizzo? I recall after the 78 shootout when Delbert Africa was publicly beaten in the streets, almost senseless by a group of police officers, that the head of the NAACP at the time, Alfonso Diehl, who later became a state representative, said at that time, he publicly called for an investigation of police abuse, and Mayor Rizzo went on the 6 o'clock news and said, as for Al Diehl, I want a piece of him myself. That was the kind of mayor that Frank Rizzo was back then. And talk about the climate that and how MOVE became a lightning rod of police abuse in those days.
You know, much like the Black Panthers and other organizations that wanted to see change, that's what MOVE was doing. That's what John Africa was about, trying to make some kind of change because of the conditions of Black people's living, and not just Black people, but poor whites and animals and the environment. We need a change. And that message was so, like, strong. And when you try to make change, when you try to do something to upset the current establishment and try to just take us in a new direction because what's happening is wrong. They don't want these things to change. They want to stay in this position of power, in this position of control. And so when anybody try to speak up, it ain't just MOVE that will run into these obstacles and in this wall of police and this wall of politicians and just trying to stop you from putting out this information. And so that's exactly what Rizzo was, like Donald Trump, you know, of that time, except he was even worse in that confined space.
Mike Africa Jr., we have to leave it there. I know your family will be doing something on Thursday on the anniversary of the 36 years ago, the police killing.
That's right.
11 people in the MOVE family. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Mike Africa, and Abdul Ali Muhammad. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening to Democracy Now! This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. We listened to the beginning of that show at the 9 o'clock hour. There were still a few minutes left that I think were very important that you hear. And so I brought that to you just now. And if you agree that Democracy Now! Is a fantastic program, like the 20 or 25 people who donated this morning, I'd like you to donate to support Democracy Now! 813-238-8001. We've also played Counterspin, and we've played the Richard Wolf Show Economic Update today. They'll be on both on every Tuesday morning at 10 for the time being. 813-238-8001 is how you can show your support. What we're going to do for the rest of this hour is we're going to listen to one or two of Daniel Figueroa IV's stories. He has produced some great stories for us lately, and some of them are really long-form features that would fit well in the news and public affairs blocks, as in addition to the headline newscasts. And so I'm bringing Daniel on to talk about some of his stories. And the first one that we're going to listen to, Daniel, is one that you called St. Pete Protest. So why don't you set up what's going to be going on in the story, and then we'll let our listeners listen to it. But before we do that, I want to remind people that if you support local news, if you support local programming, give us a call, 813-238-8001, and make a donation. You can donate as well at WMNF.org. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Sean. We're going to be taking a listen to a few stories I have produced over the last month or so. This first one is from a protest that I covered in St. Pete. Just as the controversial HB1 anti-riot bill was passed, the marchers went out shortly after Dante Wright was killed, and HB1 was passed but not signed into law yet. So no one knew what that might mean for the protest, and there was I've been covering some of these protests from both sides of the political spectrum since I started here, and you know it's one of the things I think is most important to be on the ground and be a part of the community and really know what's going on in the community, and what you know some of the activists you know regardless of what their political leanings are doing. And it was a very different sort of vibe when everyone was out there with the specter of HB1 looming over you know everyone's head, and they you know no one knew what it would mean for the march. It could have been signed into law that night, and that could have turned some of us, depending on what happened, it could have turned some of us, in myself included, into, you know, potential felons. So there was a very different atmosphere. And yeah, let's go ahead and take a listen to it.
And as we hear this story, you can donate 813-238-8001 or pledge online at WMNF.org. Here's Daniel's story right before HB1 was signed into law by Governor DeSantis.
The protest was peaceful, but it was not silent.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
More than 100 people gathered on the steps of St. Pete City Hall around 7 p.m. Most wore black, both to mourn and to stand in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Protests in St. Pete and across the world began last year after video of George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police was seen across the world. As the world awaited a verdict in the trial for Floyd's accused killer, one is expected to come this week, protesters added more names to the ever-growing list of Black Americans killed by police. Only a few miles from where the trial is taking place, Wright was shot and killed by an officer who claimed she mistook her gun for a taser. Wright was not armed. There is also Adam Toledo, the 13-year-old boy killed by police in Chicago. Police said he had a gun, but body cam footage appears to show the officer shoot Adam as both hands were raised in the air. Both hands appear to be empty. Before the march, participants spoke. HB1 was at the forefront of everyone's mind. Here's Jaleesa Blackshear of Tripartisan Canvas.
If you want to condone violence or you want escalation, please do not march with us. I will personally ask you to leave, and I'm going to take your picture, and I'm going to call you out just like I do these guys. Because we didn't come here for that. We came here to be in solidarity, and we want justice. No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
HB1, Governor Ron DeSantis' top legislative priority this year, has been accused of having a chilling effect on First Amendment freedoms. Among many aspects seen as problematic, HB1 can make even the most peaceful protesters culpable for felonious crimes if authorities decide a protest turns to a riot. It also loosens the definition of a riot and creates the mob intimidation crime. Under that section, any two or more people attempting to coerce someone to assume, abandon, or maintain a particular viewpoint against his or her will can be charged with a misdemeanor. And it offers immunity to drivers who might injure or kill marching protesters in intersections.
If the governor would have signed it tonight, I probably wouldn't have came out as far as in the street. I would have rallied, had the vigil, but I wouldn't have felt comfortable and being responsible for leading people to get felonies.
HB1 passed both chambers of Florida's legislature before the march and will go into effect immediately upon receiving the governor's signature. Blackshear said Friday's march might be her last. She'll still be pushing for equality and policy changes, but through other avenues, like lobbying local officials. Many, though, were unmoved in their convictions. Ashley Green is an organizer with Tampa Bay Dream Defenders. She said her parents fought for civil rights 50 years ago. She can't believe she still has to. Green said HB1 is frightening, especially since it could silence dissent by convicting dissenting voices with felonies, stripping them of the right to vote. But she'll still be in the streets.
My ancestors risked their lives, and I'm willing to risk my own. I just don't want to die for something. I want to live for it. I want to live for freedom. And it's so disgusting to hear people co-opt the term liberty and freedom while they are actively trying to suppress it.
For nearly 3 hours, they marched, at first in silence, sticking to sidewalks. They made their way down 2nd Avenue North and down Beach Drive, then around the Museum of Fine Arts and west across Central Avenue, heading back to City Hall once they reached 16th Street. As they passed shops and restaurants, business owners and patrons offered words of encouragement, with many raising fists up in solidarity. Passing Enigma, a bar in the Edge District, the crowd outside erupted in cheers. There was no confrontation and no violence. Once back at City Hall, Ruth Beltran, a black-identifying Dominican woman from Bradenton, spoke about her son. He turns 20 next month, the same age as Wright. She marched for him Friday. For the other mothers terrified whenever their sons and daughters leave home, she marched hoping for a day when she didn't have to wonder if a traffic stop would rob her of her son. Talking about it, she couldn't hold back the tears.
Our kids deserve a better world. Our kids deserve an opportunity to grow old, to grow past 20, past 40, and to just age and live a regular life without having to be in fear that they'll be killed, that their friends and families that will be killed for any reason, you know? Oh my goodness, it's so real.
For WMNF News, I'm Daniel Figueroa IV in St. Petersburg.
With honey, with milk, and with warm things, you'll get it back like Christmas presents. You can't get blood back. You can't get life back. And you can't get black back. Whose lives matter?
Black lives matter.
Well, that story from WMNF's Daniel Figueroa IV, was that about a month ago, perhaps, Daniel?
That was just about a month ago, just as HB1 was passed by the House and Senate, but not yet a law. So we didn't know what was going to happen, and that was almost exactly a month ago. I think that was April 16th, it was that night.
And the people were really concerned in your story that they didn't know yet if DeSantis had signed the law yet. And so once he signed the law, they felt that they would be maybe violating the law just by gathering and just in case something happened. And so already, even before the bill became a law, people were feeling that they were being silenced, that they were being kept from protesting because they were nervous that once the bill became a law, that it might stifle them. They might choose to not go out and protest.
Yeah, and unlike some of the other laws passed during the legislative session that generally go into effect on July 1st, HB1 went into effect as soon as the governor signed it. So, which is why people were concerned that night, especially that it could change the classification of the protest and that march from being a peaceful protest and march to something that could be considered a riot because the term is so loosely defined in the legislation, which is why, you know, some have said it is problematic because it creates new classes of crimes and it loosens the standard by which someone could be arrested and charged with a crime.
That's the voice of Daniel Figueroa IV, WMNF's reporter, senior news reporter. He goes out in the street and covers protests and covers all sorts of demonstrations and elections and all sorts of community events. Everything that is happening in your community, Daniel's there. He's going to cover it. He's going to talk to people, interview people, make phone calls, and follow up. My name is Sean Canaan, and we are raising funds here for Community Radio. We want to get support for this station to keep it going, to make sure that Daniel's hard-hitting news stories can continue to be put on your airwaves. We have electricity bills, we have water bills, we have tower rental and equipment fees that we need to pay, and we have subscriptions and so on, and we want to keep that going, and the only way we can do that is with your financial support. Here's the number to call if you'd like to become a member or renew your membership in WMNF, 813-238-8001. You can also call, you can also pledge on the web at WMNF.org. It's a secure website. We don't share your information with anyone. And you can become a member of the Circle of Friends, our sustaining membership there, to support the great programming that you hear, whether it's great national shows like Democracy Now! Or Counterspin Alternative Radio or Economic Update with Richard Wolf. Those are some of the national programs that we play. Or whether you support great shows like Midpoint with our local hosts and with Daniel and with me and with other local newsmakers bringing you information every single day on Midpoint. And just as a reminder, tomorrow at noon on Midpoint, Janet Scherberger is going to be in, and her guest will be Ben Montgomery, former Tampa Bay Times writer. He's written some books. He's with Axios. He's going to be in to talk about his latest book.
That's a great one.
Can't wait to hear that interview.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to listening to that one. I mean, Janet's great on her own, but Janet and Ben, that's like a master class. You know, so that's going to be exciting, and being able to, you know, pick their brains, being able to hear the conversation that the two of them have. Janet is also a fantastic journalist in her own right. Ben Montgomery is a, you know, best-selling author and celebrated journalist as well. And again, you know, these are voices you hear on WMNF on a regular basis. This is what we provide to the community with your support. So, you know, hopefully you out there listening enjoy that as well. And I hope you find some value in the work that I do and can share that with us and show your support for locally produced community radio, as well as alternative radio and voices that you're just not going to find anywhere else in the Tampa Bay area by calling, visiting WMNF.org, and making those pledges, making those donations, and keeping this news on the air.
Yeah, this is the way we do it. 70% of our operating budget comes from donations by listeners, by people in our community, whether that's people who have been donating since 1978 when the station founders went door to door and got contributions from people at their doorways, to when the station went on the air in September of 1979, when it went on the air 24 hours a day. For the last 42 years almost, we've been on the air, and we've been coming to you during we used to do it every three times a year. We do a weekly fundraiser. Well, now we're only doing one or two days at a time. We think it breaks it up better. It's better to listen to, and it's better for us to ask you for your donations for only a couple of days at a time. We started yesterday. This mini fund drive will end tonight. And so this is the very last hour or so of we're going to be asking for donations during news and public affairs today. We'll come back to you for 2 days next week, Thursday and Wednesday. And we'll be asking you for your donations as well then. But then it will take a month and a half off or so. We're not going to ask for any donations on the air during June. So we think that you like this type of fundraising better. We think it's less intrusive. We get to back to our normal programming very quickly. Tomorrow's going to be 100% normal programming. And the only way we can do that is with your financial support. We need to hear from you. 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org.
And we've got a lot of exciting things coming up. We're going to take a listen to some more of my stories, which admittedly is a little slightly weird for me to pitch my own stories.
Yeah.
But you know, I love being out there in the community. I love what I do. I feel so blessed and honored to be able to be the senior news reporter at this station and tell these stories to the community. And I can't do that without your help. And so, you know, please help me continue to do this thing that I love and share this information. I mean, I'm even as we speak right now, as I'm talking to you, I'm texting sources and trying to get a source ready for an interview for a story that I'm producing for this afternoon, which is going to be another new story that's pretty exciting and a little concerning. It has to do with some activist groups that are a little violent in the area, and I've been following as they progress and the ebbs and flows of their actions within the city of Tampa and just the general Tampa Bay area. So that is, you know, these are the things that we're following that we pay attention to pretty closely, and not a lot of other people have the ability to, and not a lot of other people give the time to. There are some great, great news outlets in this area, but there's only one WMNF. There's only one station that is as closely dedicated to this community and to amplifying the voices of this community that don't always get heard. That's WMNF. We're the ones who do that, and we need your help to do that. So please continue to call and make those donations. I can see, you know, we've got some folks calling in right now. Thank you all so much. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your support and allowing me to continue to have this honor of reporting news in the Tampa Bay area.
And Daniel will be able to continue to report the news if you support it by calling 813-238-8001. You can also make your donation to support local news on WMNF.org. It's our secure website. I want to thank everyone who has donated so far. I want to thank you either by name or anonymously when we come back after the NPR headlines. But please, right now, donate by calling 813-238-8001. This is WMNF.